Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Lisette Baron Carvajal, a host of the channel. Today, we will be talking to David Witt about his fantastic book, Atlantic Africa and the Spanish Caribbean, 1570-1640, published for the Omohundro Institute by University of North Carolina Press in 2016. Welcome, David. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Lisette. It's a pleasure.
So I wonder if you can begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you came to study history and Latin American history in particular, and then focus on the Caribbean. From the book, we learned that you did your graduate studies at Vanderbilt University and you work with Jane Landers. It seems that this was the ideal environment for you to develop this project in particular. So can you tell us a little bit about this, the history behind your book?
Sure, definitely. It was an ideal environment for me in a lot of ways. I came from a military and academic family background. We moved around a lot. But by the time I was about 8, we moved to the U.S. Deep South, first Mississippi, and then to Alabama, where my family's from. I went to college in Memphis, Tennessee, where I studied writing, literature, and Spanish. And then my very last semester in college, I took a class called Religion in Colonial Latin America with Mike LaRosa, who was very kind. And I loved it. I was out of school for a while after that, but I got to do some traveling and more language study and reading on my own. I stayed in touch with Mike, and he encouraged me to try grad school. So I ended up entering a master's program in Latin American studies at Vanderbilt. I had no intention of becoming a historian initially. I was thinking of trying to become a librarian afterwards, actually. But my advisor at Vanderbilt, Jane Landers, had this huge impact on me. It really changed my life. I had read her book, Black Society in Spanish Florida, which I think anyone else who has seen it might recognize, right? That it was just really a huge, huge influence on me. At the same time, in person, she was so kind and patient and encouraging to me that I'm really amazed still at this wonderful environment that I found myself in to start a project like this. So I ended up staying to do a PhD. As a master's student, I had focused on 18th century Alabama. I wanted to figure out what slavery and race relations were like there when it was part of French Louisiana or part of Spanish West Florida, when they were a little more directly connected to the Caribbean. But, not the same as the antebellum United States, right? So I started to realize that from the point of view of Latin American history or African or Iberian history, that the patterns and the people I was fascinated by in 18th century Mobile were really sort of among the final stages of a much deeper story of European colonization using slave labor, of Africans' imprint on American society. So I realized that some of the central places in the story were on the other side of the Gulf of Mexico, out in the Caribbean, during a much earlier period.
So I just wonder how, you've kind of given us clues, but how then you came into the topic of this book in particular? It is the product of your dissertation, your graduate studies at Vanderbilt. But I'm just wondering how much the project changed in all of this long process. How did it, you know, how did it change from a dissertation to the actual book? Did you know when you started the PhD that Africa, Atlantic Africa, was going to have such a prominent role in the book? Or did you figure it out as you were writing the dissertation? How did that happen?
Yeah, well, so at the time I started working on my coursework for my PhD, I already knew that my dissertation would involve Africans in the Spanish Caribbean during the 16th and 17th centuries. I didn't know what I would find in the archives. I didn't know how much my arguments are going to evolve over time. Even before finishing the dissertation, I realized that it would be a lot more useful and more interesting to me if it did incorporate Africa and African histories a lot more, not only studying African populations in the Americas, but also the history of the places where many of them came from. So this ended up taking a lot more time and involving much more work than I'd expected. In the interest of time, I ended up actually, even in writing the book later, I had to end up choosing which regions of Africa, which African histories, because there are a lot and very different, which ones would be the most helpful for me. I was very fortunate to find a job in a place that had really good African history collections in the library. And also I was very lucky to win a NEH fellowship that allowed me to spend a whole year after I had finished the dissertation, that allowed me to spend a whole year doing a lot more reading and writing those initial chapters that really focus on two broad regions in Atlantic Africa.
Well, it's excellent to hear this, because I think for anyone that is listening and they're working on their dissertation, it's just wonderful to hear that it's a long process and one doesn't necessarily know how is it going to end. So it's great to listen to like different experiences and how you eventually figure things out, and it takes some time, and that's fine. So I guess now I want us to move to the book. But before tackling the main argument, I want you to tell us a little bit about some of the assumptions that your book is challenging. You mentioned two in particular that I thought it was very interesting. So first, that a large-scale export-oriented sugar industry was the intrinsic destiny of all Caribbean colonies. So you're challenging that idea. And also, the second idea is that slavery was primarily important for colonies oriented toward extraction or exploitation rather than settlement. So I would love if you could explain to our listeners why you think that the literature, the emphasis on industrial scale sugar complexes and slave resistance in later periods, so the periods you initially started studying, the 18th and 19th centuries, how that emphasis is not that it's wrong or mistaken, but rather has obscured a previous history, the history that you're actually telling in your book?
Sure, yeah. So the way I ended up crystallizing the problem that my book was really trying to answer was this. Did the historical documents show that there were these major black populations, black majority populations, and prominently African populations in the main port cities of the Spanish Caribbean during this period that I was looking at? The slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, was not only continuing, it was growing, it's increasing in intensity. So the question was, what were all these Africans doing in these places that didn't have large-scale plantations, that didn't have massive sugar cultivation or export commodities? So the models that historians of slavery in the Americas have tended to work with, to me, they didn't answer this question. They didn't explain this problem. So, you know, for example, historians have talked about slave societies as opposed to societies with slaves, or urban slavery as opposed to rural slavery. And there's other models that are, you know, very interesting, and I think they work, but they didn't fit for the places and period that I was looking at. And I think mainly it's because one of the main reasons is because they're designed to address 18th century and 19th century problems and questions. So what I started to ask myself was, if all these enslaved people, if all these Africans, if they weren't working on plantations, what in the world were they doing? Right? What were they all doing here and why? And so I started to just check the documents and read as many secondary works as I could also, because there's also some fantastic literature written mostly in Spanish on these different regions and ports that were very, very helpful. And so the historical evidence indicates that rural slave labor in these places, the ones I was looking at, mainly consisted of farming and ranching. There was also domestic service, transportation, especially in boats or canoes, logging. There was some mining, and there was some plantation labor, but mostly what they called estancias or farms, which involved people growing corn or yuca or plantains, or working on ranches called or corrals called atos and corrales with livestock, usually cattle or pigs. So it's much more labor geared towards sustenance and regional trade rather than these export commodities. And so in the end, I realized that Africans weren't just replacing. So the argument that historians like to use to summarize is that there were first Native American populations that were decimated by, for various causes, but especially colonization, brutal treatment, and disease. And then they were replaced by Africans. So I started to realize, at least the way I saw it, was that all these Africans were not just replacing Native Americans who were doing these sort of labors that nobody else wanted to do or could be forced to do. They were also replacing Iberians. They were replacing non-elite Spanish workers who, for the most part, stayed back in Europe and who didn't have the resources or the desire to travel to the Americas to do the same type of labor they were already doing back in Europe. So this is where I started to become very interesting in the idea that these categories of African slave and Spanish settler or colonist, which are problematic terms, I think, these categories are a little bit too sharp and too distinct. And I started to become very interested in playing with those ideas and looking at the places where they become blurry or overlap, essentially.
Well, so, I mean, this leads us to your argument, right? An argument that has two main components that I think are equally fascinating. So the first component, and as the title already suggests, is that the Caribbean is an extension of an older, deeper African and Iberian world, one characterized by violence, forced migration, and slavery. In other words, you argued that the history of the Caribbean cannot be disentangled from Iberia and the Atlantic African world, which is something you've kind of already mentioned. And the second part of your argument, as your answer was already suggesting, is that disentangled histories explain why sub-Saharan Africans became the colonists of the Spanish Caribbean. And I guess you can explain to us why you find these categories not super useful or problematic. But as you say it, I think your argument is that the extensive participation of Luso-Africans, Latinized Africans, and free people of color made possible Spain's colonization of the region. So it's not simply they replaced indigenous people, but they made possible colonization, right? So I think here there's so many questions I could add, but one of the things that intrigued me the most is that by this period, you argue, there was not yet a consolidation of stark racial categories. So knowing that the question I'm going to ask is a very difficult one and debated one, I would ask you then if you would argue that racism as we understand it today did not exist yet or existed differently, I don't know. And also, going back to the question about categories, so it's just a basic question. Can a person be a colonist or a settler while at the same time being enslaved or forced to migrate?
These are excellent and very, very big questions, right? First of all, about the existence of racism and racial categories, I would say, in the period and places that I was looking at, I would say yes, that what we might attitudes that we would today consider racism did exist. That's my strong impression, right? But I would say not in the same way, because race wasn't viewed in the same way in this sort of early modern Iberian and African context. It wasn't viewed in the same way race is viewed in different parts of the world today. It was viewed differently in this period, you know, chronologically too. So the idea of, you know, racial identities weren't quite the same. And I provide some examples of where racial identity was, you know, often quite fluid. I think we're moving back into today in a period where this is more more common understanding. But a lot of the literature that talks about, when historians have talked about slavery in different parts of the world in different periods, they're often treating racial categories and thus racism as if we're a fairly unchanging and fairly static pattern of action, right? So in this early modern Iberian and African world, slaves were people, right? So the word chattel, for example, which we read all the time when we read scholarship on slavery, chattel slavery, the idea of slaves as movable property, right? And slave people in the Iberian, in this Iberian and African world, they were property, but they were also people, right? So, and this is one of many things that I learned from my mentor, Jane Landers. I've still never been able to find the equivalent of a word for chattel in Spanish or Portuguese. I don't think it exists. Another thing to consider is that Iberians themselves could be enslaved, not only in, say, North Africa or the Ottoman world, but Iberians in this period in Iberia could be enslaved if they had Muslim ancestors, right? So there's as I mentioned earlier, one big recurring theme in the book involves trying to look closely at these fuzzy or blurry spaces in which the categories of African and Iberian kind of overlap. And slavery is one place where we start to see some interesting and nuanced spaces that we're not used to talking about in the 19th century, for example. So at the same time, as I see these this need for nuance when we talk about who can be a slave and racial categories, at the same time, there is plenty of evidence for the brutal treatment of enslaved people and unequal treatment towards people of African origin or people who are described as black or brown, right? So I think a lot depends on how we today choose to interpret that evidence and how much we assume that this world that existed 400 years ago basically resembles the 20th century United States, for example. After some time, I came to believe that it did not resemble the world, but other people could focus on the, I think justifiably focus on the similarities, though I chose not to. So onto the terms of colonist or settler, right? So when I use those terms in the book, I definitely try to qualify them, right? So for example, I will say, surrogate settler, right? When applying them to African people who were in the Caribbean completely against their will, completely involuntarily in the first place, right? One other of the book's sort of recurring themes is that Africans' experiences were very often ambiguous. So whereas I studied and began with these sort of paradigms of oppression and resistance, right? But I think these paradigms don't really explain how these societies functioned when these major Spanish Caribbean port cities were sort of, their existence was predicated on a majority of population of African and African descended people who essentially carried out almost every necessary task for these places to exist. So there's Africans and people of African descent within Spanish Caribbean society that are kind of being, very much are being silenced or ignored when we talk about sort of binary slavery resistance, oppression and resistance paradigms. This is to take a modern equivalent to talk about, you know, I'm from the Deep South, right? To talk about Southerners, right? Overlooking the fact that, you know, a huge percentage of the population historically in the Deep South have been, you know, black people of African descent, right? So it's a way of creating good guys and bad guys, essentially, or creating oversimplified narratives, I think, that cut out a lot of people. So another example from the book, there's a passage when I speak about one free woman of color who was a slave owner, right? She owned slaves, two, I think. But it turns out one of the enslaved people that she owned, she had traded them in hopes of gaining the freedom of her own son who was enslaved. And in the meantime, this same woman was paying off, as I eventually found out, she was paying off the money that she still owed for her own freedom, right? So, you know, I think we have to be really careful about the way we characterize not only racial identities in this period, but what does slavery mean? What does doing the labor that we associate with being a colonist or a settler, what does that labor entail, right? Who was really doing that? So essentially, I have to think we have to redefine to look at this period and these places and these people. We have to consider what slavery meant for them, what this labor that sustained colonial society, what it meant for them, right? And how we try to get closer to the world that they experienced, I suppose, instead of imposing our categories back on that time period without considering how those places were so different from our own and those and the people, the world that they experienced was so different from the world that we live in.
Yeah, no, and I think you do such a terrific job in showing the nuances, you know, in not downplaying the violence and at the same time showing the freedoms people could have or enslaved people could have or the opportunities they had for mobility, et cetera, et cetera. And I think for our listeners out there, I mean, if they want to read many, many different examples, the case you just mentioned, but many, many other more, you know, you have to go and get the book because it's such an excellent book that gives you so many rich examples and cases. So now I guess let's kind of move to time and space, right? So as a good historian, you clearly set a very defined temporal frame. And I mean, you draw many, many, many examples and from many different places, right? So can you explain to our listeners why these dates and not other dates? And why, in addition of including Atlantic Africa, which is not much of a choice, but actually your argument, right? But why did you choose the Caribbean cities that you choose? Cartagena, Havana, Santo Domingo, Panama City. So why this and not other Caribbean cities? Can you tell us a little bit about that? Those choices?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So first, the time frame I chose, I started with approximately 1570. And this is a little fuzzier because in the history of the Caribbean, especially for some places that were considered main Spanish settlements, essentially, the rise of the Indies fleets, the Carrera de Indias, the often called the treasure fleets or the treasure galleons. This fleet system was really organized, and there's some listeners will probably have seen a book by Alejandro de la Fuente, which talks about the impact of these fleets and this fleet system in Havana, which was a very useful study for me. So it wasn't just Havana; these fleets, which started in the 1560s, they ended up becoming really important in attracting resources and population to Havana and to Cartagena de Indias, to Cartagena in present-day Colombia. And so they're seen as I think justifiably seen as one of the main reasons that these cities grew and thrived and became really important places, really starting in the 1570s and then even more so later in the 1500s and into the early 1600s. At the same time, these fleets, this fleet system has widely been considered one of the main reasons why other important port cities like Santo Domingo and what's today the Dominican Republic, right, among others, became less important, really, and sort of started to decline because as resources were moved away from some places and concentrated in other places. So the 1570s basically is a period when this process starts to unfold. It's also about 10 years before the Iberian Union, which is when, because of some political events and military events, essentially in Morocco, but also in Portugal and Spain, Spain, starting in 1580, 1581, Spain and the monarchs of Spain, also the Habsburgs, right, the Austrias, they start to also control Portugal and the Portuguese Empire in 1580. So for this period of about 60 years, the Spanish and Portuguese empires are theoretically separate, but they are governed by the same monarchs. And there is a period of really intense interaction and collaboration between the Spanish and Portuguese overseas worlds, right? And this was already unfolding before 1580, but it seems to have intensified a lot in the 1580s. And it lasts. So now, the reason I ended in 1640, it lasts until 1640. There are certainly continued echoes and repercussions of this period afterwards. But in 1640, the Portuguese Braganza, this new dynasty in Portugal, takes power back. Essentially, Portugal has its independence again after 1640. To summarize, and it's really, in some ways, I see it as the end of an era in a lot of ways, especially in thinking of the transatlantic slave trade that connected ports in Western Africa to ports in the Spanish Caribbean and the Rio de la Plata. Although, there are people working now on ways that these patterns continued, right? But I really wanted to emphasize 1640 as an end point, because I think it's been too easy to slip into analysis of the 18th century and 19th century or patterns from those later periods when talking about this earlier period. So I wanted to make it very clear that from about the 1570s to about 1640, the reason I chose these cities that I chose, so Cartagena de Indias, Havana, also Santo Domingo, also Panama City, and also Puerto Rico, which I could have done a lot more, Jamaica, which I could have done some more with. I wanted to look at cities where there was a really strong African presence, first of all. And second of all, where there were, where I knew of very useful sources, where I knew there would be good sources. If I had tackled earlier periods in the 16th century, I think I could have done a lot more. Now I know I could have done a lot more with Santo Domingo, for example, with Hispaniola in general, and with Puerto Rico, actually. But for the period I looked on, Havana, I knew there were excellent sources for Havana that I could use. And I knew that there were excellent sources for Cartagena. And I increasingly focused more and more actually on Cartagena as my research went on.
Yeah, and I guess this leads us to the typical historian's question, right? Which is sources and archives, because you do so much with sources and with so many different archives and types of sources, right? Tell us about that. Tell us about one of the main components of your book, which is these tables and appendix that you include at the end, in which you list people, their, you know, their occupation, name, status, sex. Tell us how you gather such rich and, you know, incredibly, I don't know, it's just detailed information, right? And I was just reading the book and I was like, wow, it's just, there's so many names here. There's so many histories. So how did you like get all of this and rich information? And like, how was it, you know, the time you took to assemble all of this, because it seems like a very labor intensive work.
It was pretty labor intensive, but I think one of the things that I most enjoyed about the project was working in the archives, and it's something I try to spend as much time in the archives as I can. It's one of the things I really enjoy. So in this case, for this project, I spent a lot of time in the Archives of the Indies, Archivo General de Indias, in Seville, Spain. I stayed for about 20 months. I had a Fulbright grant, which was wonderful. I had some other support from the Conference on Latin American History. And for several months, I had no funding at all. But it was a wonderful experience and very useful. I had hoped to systematically explore sources, especially for, I was focusing mainly at that time on Cartagena and on Havana, and I had hoped to systematically explore all of the available sources for both port cities for this period of about 70 years that I was studying in the Archive of the Indies. It turns out this archive is, it's really probably the single most important archive for historical material for now, right? For historical materials on the early colonial Caribbean. There's also really good material in Bogota, in Colombia, and there are other places, right? But I ended up focusing on the Spanish archives, which contain just huge amounts of information, including not just sort of imperial level correspondence, but correspondence of enslaved people, for example, or free people of color, or everyday sort of tax records, legal case, all sorts of materials. So, as anyone who's worked there could have told me, David, there's no way you'll have time to systematically explore everything. So I ended up essentially doing what I could, and when I found a group of documents that looked, really useful, I would focus on them. I was reading a lot of secondary works on these studies that were very helpful in pointing me towards useful useful sources. So for example, books by Antonino Vidal, by María Carmen Borrego Plá, by El Sagel Pibai. So there were just, lots of books that were very, very useful for me. And so they gave me good pointers. But every now and then I would stumble upon a big group of documents that hadn't been worked by any before, like royal officials' letters. So they're always interested in talking about or writing about whatever economic activity brings them money for the Spanish crown. So for Havana, there's a lot of information on royal slaves, on enslaved people owned by the crown, which was interesting, right, and useful. But in Cartagena, the big money-making industry was this transatlantic slave trade. So I found that the royal officials of Cartagena had lots and lots and lots of letters about slave trading and about the traffic in enslaved Africans. So I had a list of kind of my top picks, I guess, my favorite documents, and I tried to bring those into the story as much as possible.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I think you managed to get so many histories in the book. That is remarkable, and the appendix and the tables gives a sense of the vastness of the project, right? So now that we've discussed this big picture, I guess it's important to flag to our readers that though your book is not technically divided in parts or sections, you do say that the first half of the book, that is the first three chapters, illustrate the degree to which Spanish and Caribbean society during this period was an extension of the Luso-African Atlantic world. So please talk to us about this section, and in particular about the events and precedents in Upper Guinea and West Central Africa, events you discuss in chapter 1 and 2, respectively. So how are the histories of these regions different from one another? And how does that difference explains what later, what happened in the Caribbean? Because I think they have very different stories, right? I was so fascinated by how you were able to trace histories, names, ethnonyms, and toponyms of Upper Guinean men and women, and how you were not able to do the same, because then you will explain us why you couldn't do the same with West Central Africa. And so I was also struck by how, much more violent things were in West Central Africa. So can you tell us about those differences between those two regions and just introduce us a little bit to the histories of those places.
Sure. This is what I spent most of my time working on after completing the dissertation, and I felt it would be very useful to do exactly that, to try to characterize and summarize from what I have been able to gather, right, by reading histories of Upper Guinea or Greater Senegambia, and by reading histories of West Central Africa, so Congo, Angola, Benguela, because there's excellent work on both. And that was a lot of the scholarship that I was really trying to, in some ways, emulate and to build on, just looking at different places and early time periods. So this first chapter on Upper Guinea, or sort of the Senegambian region, one thing that really stood out to me was, and again, I was building on the work of historians of that region, was that enslaved people from those places in the Spanish Caribbean, they tended to be described not with terms like just racial terms or just being called a Guinea, right? Some sort of general term, and with like what we see in American English, like guinea pig or guinea hen or you know, that sort of thing, but very detailed ethnonyms or toponyms. For example, Biafara or Biojo or Bijago and others. I focused on about 10 of those different terms, and I found that some of them were very, very specific and actually match the identifications that some people in West Africa use for themselves today. Whereas others are a little bit less specific or very much less specific and tend to be sort of umbrella terms like Mandinga or Sape, right? These are terms that are not so specific and have multiple interpretations. So there was... during the time I was working on this book, especially in the late 90s, really, and then in the early 2000s, there was a lot of debate among historians of diasporic African peoples. What do these terms mean? How much trust can we put in these terms? To what extent were they just really terms used by slave traders or terms used to that grew up during the slave trade and terms that that later Africans in the Americas used themselves and appropriated those terms to talk about their own identities? And to what extent were they really invented identities as they evolved over time in context of American slavery, right? So most of that scholarship really deals with the 18th and 19th centuries. And it also deals with different, you know, various regions of Atlantic Africa. So here I focus specifically on this region of Africa, and I made the argument, right, that not only can we use these terms to sort of analyze with greater precision what were the experiences of some of these enslaved Africans who were, you know, forcibly transported to the Americas as slaves, right? And I also tried to explain, how were they enslaved? What are some of the processes that might have led to their enslavement? And I think we can talk about this with some specificity in a lot of cases. I also wanted to sort of emphasize that the reason these terms continue to exist in the Caribbean was that Iberians, so Portuguese, Luso Africans, based, for example, in the Caribbean, in the Cape Verde Islands, and also Spanish people, had all sorts of different relationships of trade, diplomacy, evangelization projects. With people all along the Upper Guinea coast and the rivers of Guinea, as they were called, in addition to slaving and slave trading. And Iberians didn't really have this position in the 16th century or the early 17th century where they could impose their will on African peoples at all, right? So, and this is not my discovery. Other, as I said, historians of Western Africa have written about this. But I wanted to... explore, right? What happens when we take that context and as it starts to become transposed into the Caribbean, right? And we see these patterns of cross-cultural exchange that already exist, a lot of different languages and multiple identities among people from that region of West Africa. What happens when that comes over to the Spanish Caribbean also? You know, we could talk a lot more about that. I have examples in the book where we have actually very powerful political leaders in the Upper Guinea coast whose names are remembered and people take on their identities, right? In Central America, for example. So it's for me a fascinating context that I've remained really interested in. and by contrast, right? And I really wanted to emphasize in the book how different West Central Africa is from the Upper Guinea Coast, that we can't just talk about Africans in a really generalized fashion, if we want to be historically accurate. I, you know, building on works of other previous historians, especially John Thornton, right, but also Beatrix Heinz and others, there's some really fantastic scholarship on West Central Africa. I wanted to emphasize how different it was in a lot of ways. So the chronological frame is different. West Central Africa, people from Angola, especially, but also Congo, well, they all start to come into the Spanish Caribbean really in larger numbers at the very end of the 16th century. And so this is often a product of very violent efforts to colonize Portugal, violent Portuguese efforts to colonize Angola, to make it a colony of Portugal. There was these genuine attempts to sort of conquer and to extract not only resources, but tribute from conquered populations in Angola. So very different context. We see, especially after this initial period of violence, we see also from West Central Africa, we see a lot of women and especially children, and people who today we would consider children. So people under the age of, say, 14 or 15, who were being brought to the Caribbean as captives. So different dynamics of enslavement, violence in both contexts, but really more widespread and more systematic violence, and more colonialist violence, I think, in the West Central African context. And again, I'm building on the works of historians who've already written about this. Another thing that I noticed a lot in the West Central African case was some specific individuals who were involved in Portuguese colonization of Angola also showed up as captains or shipmasters or passengers on slave ships in the Spanish Caribbean. So there's a really direct, concentrated in some ways process. Again, and at least Felipe Alan Castro has spoken about this also for Brazil, right? The way that his book is recently translated into English, actually, which is fantastic. There's this simultaneous colonization, a Portuguese colonization of Angola and Spanish colonization of the Caribbean happening. And you can see there's really an integrated process in some ways. So essentially, I wanted to sort of emphasize these different historical patterns in the different regions of Atlantic Africa, and the way that they were reflected differently in the Spanish Caribbean, the sort of overlapping patterns. And you know, when I go into a lot more detail about what happens when you have most of the enslaved African population being Upper Guineans for several, you know, decades, and then there's this new influx of essentially war captives or people who were paid as tribute in Angola.
Yeah, and I mean, this definitely comes in those two chapters, the differences in the, you know, in the trajectories and how those two regions shaped or affected differently the history of the Caribbean. Then, I mean, we're going to skip chapter 3 because I want us to kind of focus on the second part of your book. But just to flag her to our listeners, here you focus on Tango Mouse and Luso Africans, so on figures that work as go-betweens and that were important in establishing connections between the Luso Atlantic world and Africans and their descendants in the Caribbean. So I'm not going to get into that chapter, but just for, you know, if our listeners are interested in those kind of topics, histories, they should go and check out chapter 3. Because, so I want us to move to the second part of your book, that, as I said, is not technically a section, but you tell us that in this part, you focus more on the concrete cases, examples in which Africans and their descendants actually settled in the Caribbean. And you show how they were essential for these early phases of Spanish colonialism. So the fourth chapter that is titled Ñaras and Morenas Horras. So that's my favorite. Perhaps I'm biased because I am a historian of women and gender, but I was just so struck by the richness of the cases, the many names, histories, just the many instances that you track down, right? So tell us about women such as María de Torres and Enríquez. Tell us about you know, their marriages, their informal liaisons with Black or Iberian men. Tell us about the roles that they had in this, in their societies, and the power they held, because as you tell us, many of them were powerful. And again, that shows a connection with the African world, because you say that some roles kind of resemble one another, though they were not exactly the same, right? The role of women back in Africa and the role that they had in the Caribbean. But there are some, you know, similarities. So tell us about the women.
Okay, yeah, this may be my favorite chapter too, honestly. I think it's one of the, maybe a core chapter for my argument, along with the chapter 5, actually. And I have to say, you know, I'm still very grateful to my editor of the book, Frederica Toit, who made me rewrite this chapter in particular extensively, and definitely for the better, I think. So a lot of, many historians have written about, not only about the Caribbean, but other places, about the absence of white women as sort of a main factor driving social relationships between European men and African and African descended women, and about, you know, even about sort of creolization or the formation of new societies, because the white women weren't there. So, you know, one of my hooks, I guess, for this chapter is what happens if we look, instead of at the absence of white women, if we look at the presence of African women, women of African descent, how do we make this a story about the people who are there, right? And so in African histories, nyaras, or which comes from the Portuguese word senhora, or it later become in French, senhor, which is a little better known term, or donas in a West Central African context. These are powerful women who become intermediaries and often liaisons and partners for European administrators, essentially. I think they become very powerful people, right? I think they provided for me a really good model for looking at the position and the and importance of free women of African descent, including formerly enslaved women in the Caribbean. Even though they usually weren't as powerful as these nyaras in African context, I think they were equally important actors. In some ways more so, because there were a lot more of them and they were more widespread. A few months ago, I found a new document about a woman who describes herself as a mulata in the 1590s, who was actually the owner of her own ship and crossed the Atlantic and, you know, and was on her way back from Seville to the Caribbean. So this could have easily gone in this chapter. But there's a lot of information along these lines. One of the things that I argue and expand a little on the conclusion is we can really transform, I think, the way we view Spanish Caribbean society by looking at the roles of women, and especially African women, and their widespread participation. One of the things I did was I looked at parish records, right, so baptism and marriage records, to track the way one woman was changed in the way she was identified over time. At first, she was identified as being from a region in West Central Africa, the slave of a person named so-and-so Abalos, Leonor, and Chica, slave of so-and-so Abalos. But later, over time, she becomes Leonor Abalos, a free Black woman, right? And so I track the process by which she sort of takes on this Iberian identity in these records. And I argue that it's probable that many free women of African descent who only show up in a record as Black or a mulatta or something, right, that they probably went through a very similar process. So there's, and, you know, there's other examples at sort of more middle levels, I suppose, women who are married to Iberian men and how they start to be identified not in racial terms, but as the wife of so-and-so, right? It was a fun chapter, and I'm really glad that you found it interesting.
Yeah, no, I found it fantastic. And you show the centrality of these female figures in their societies and the different roles they performed, the kind of mobility they could carve out for themselves. So I just thought it was such a terrific chapter and so important for your overall argument, right? Right alongside that chapter, you know, 5. So maybe I'm going to condense the two last chapters, and I'm going to allow you to talk about whatever you want to talk, but maybe you can talk, you know, tell us about these other figures you kind of mentioned here, Black peasants, right? And Tell us a little bit about how they became Latin, quote unquote, that this is the topic of chapter six, right? So you argue that the Latinization of enslaved Africans was very important for Spanish colonization of the Caribbean. And when you say Latinization, and what people understood at the time for that was actually the use of the Spanish language and the practice of Catholicism, right? So maybe you can tell us about the figures of these Black peasants and at the same time about the process of becoming Latin and how there were terms like bozal or ladino and how they were important in describing these processes of becoming or, you know, a culture, quote unquote, though that word can be problematic because, as you're arguing, this was a much more complex process. It wasn't just that, you know, Africans and their descendants just like learn how to be Hispanics, but you know, they were able to maintain their culture, their memories, their traditions. So tell us about all of, you know, all of these aspects of these two chapters.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So both of them, along with the previous chapter, both of them, they're really interested in trying to understand how Africans sort of became the sort of the baseline for Spanish colonial presence in the Caribbean, and especially in these areas that I'm looking at. First of all, the term Black peasants, I liked the terminology because it plays with some of our assumptions about, you know, these are terms that are often racially charged and they're used in specific contexts. I mean, specific things. The term peasants doesn't really work in the Iberian context. The idea of the people who performed rural labor, the categories are a little bit different. But I like the idea of juxtaposing these two. So as I mentioned earlier, a lot of enslaved people are growing food rather than, you know, or ranching, right? Animal husbandry rather than cultivating sugar. The places with the most dense African populations were the ones that were least invested in sugar cultivation. So as I mentioned earlier, I argued that enslaved Africans are essentially replacing people who would be considered the equivalent of peasants in Iberian Peninsular Iberian context. I also found a lot of free people of color, including women, often former slaves, often Africans, people who were described by, you know, African ethnonyms, signaling that they were born in Africa. A lot of people who owned rural property, who owned farms or who owned ranches, which was fascinating to me. So you have these rural spaces in and around Caribbean port cities that are not only operated by Africans and people of African descent, but also owned, right, by former slaves, formerly enslaved people, including Africans, right. So for chapter six, the idea of becoming Latin again, I agree that it's I wanted to be very careful about not characterizing Africans who become identified as Ladino or Latinized, essentially, as losing their African heritages or their African identities. Or, you know, one of the fundamental assumptions I was working under is that people can have multiple identities and people don't have to have, you know, merely one identity or another identity, right? And I'm, you know, building on the work of some linguists who've done some really interesting work there. And I'm building on the work of historians and, you know, anthropologists a little bit too, who go, you know, back to Fernando Ortiz's transculturation, and then criticisms of his work that have argued that, well, the idea of transculturation sort of, you know, is a way of skipping over African history. So I was building on those sort of debates. One of the ways that I attacked, sort of a central mission for me was to show Africans as being the primary participants and primary agents in these processes of integrating themselves into Spanish Caribbean society and making Spanish Caribbean society more African in a lot of ways. So rather than emphasizing, for example, Pedro Claver or Alonso de Sandoval, these famous, very important Jesuits who were missionaries to Africans, to enslaved Africans in Cartagena de Indias, I looked at the interpreters, the African interpreters who worked for them, building on, you know, works by other people, drawing on some excellent resources by Ana Maria Splendiani, for example. I also looked at godparents and godparentage. In Havana, we have excellent baptismal records that can be viewed online, actually, through the Slave Society's digital archive, which is at Vanderbilt. we have great information on people for the 1590s in Havana who were, there were some I was able to track both the time they were baptized and the time they started to serve as godparents for other newly arrived Africans. And this is, I think, another really important process by which Spanish colonization was able to sort of continue in the Caribbean, where you had Africans serving as intermediaries for other Africans. And I tried to be careful to point out that it wasn't just Africans becoming Christians and agents of Spanish colonization that were inducting other Africans. The sources don't really let us see many times what Africans were saying to other Africans, right? So they're not necessarily straight up agents of colonization and empire, right? But we can see that Africans were the ones who were mainly responsible for bringing other Africans into this system. And, you know, maybe they use the Spanish language and Catholicism as common reference points because they were from very different places. But it doesn't mean that they stopped being Africans or having African, various African value systems and ideas about themselves and one another.
Yeah, I mean, I think the difficulty of the kind of topics you are handling here and the nuances, those are the reasons why this book is so important and it's such a great read, and I cannot recommend it enough to our listeners. So, you know, so they go ahead and buy the book and read it because it's fantastic. So I've taken a lot of your time, David, already, but let's finish up with the question that I've been doing here for the New Books Network, and that is, why do you think this history is important for the present? Why should we read it today? Maybe some of our listeners are wondering, like, oh, what does a history that took place so long ago, why does it matter today? So can you tell us a little bit of what you've thought about this question?
Sure. Yeah, I have some different ways of thinking about this, but I think the one that's really most important for me, and maybe in the long term even, is when people think about themselves today or the places they're from, or they're, you know, and I mean, in my case, from the deep south of the United States, people often to think about, you know, they say, don't forget where you come from, right? And that sort of thing. When people think about where they come from, they don't tend to go very far back in time in many cases, right? So we tend to think of, the early 20th century, the 19th century, maybe the 18th century as sort of the deep past. But, I think ultimately, one of the main contributions I hope that my book will make is to help people realize that, there's this earlier periods, right, that not only shaped the recent past, the relatively recent past, but also indirectly ended up shaping and influencing the present conditions, right? I think of when we look back in terms of race relations and slavery and the way it influences, and racism, actually, the way they influence all sorts of things today. Some of the worst aspects of the world today, I would argue, are really continuations of things that happened in the past. You know, I think it's possible to think about the 18th and 19th centuries as sort of an in-between stage. Things weren't necessarily any better or any less violent before then, but there was certainly change over a long period of time. So we have these historical precedents for nuanced and complex and ambiguous identities that I think are very useful today. We just have to look a little bit farther back in time.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's super useful to see how identities were just not fixed, you know? It was so much more fluidity that we sometimes think of today, right? So, okay, so before finishing up, tell us what are you working on today? We met at the Archive Indias this past summer, so I know you were doing some research there. So tell us about the project, your next project. What are you thinking you're going to write about next?
Thank you for asking. It's fun. I've already been having a really fun time continuing to do research in archives in Spain, especially the Archive of the Indies. But also, I've been working a lot in the Canary Islands and notarial records there, where there's just a wonderful literature of scholarship by historians that's not very well known out, unfortunately, outside of the Canary Islands and outside of Spanish academia. There's also excellent work on, some other places. So what I'm interested now in is looking at the Canary Islands, also in relation to the Cape Verde Islands and certain places in the Caribbean. I'm interested in, my current project sort of tries to articulate this this in-between space, or a place, the spaces that are often thought of as in-between. It's a slightly different, it involves a lot of, there's a lot of captivity and a lot of slave trafficking and a lot of enslaved and formerly enslaved people, who were some of the main actors and the intermediaries, you know, which I'm still fascinated by. But it's a little bit more out on the ocean, and it looks at places that are, yeah, that are connected to each other in some different types of ways, slightly different project. And also, I go a little farther back in time. I spend a lot more time in the early 16th century on this next project. Also, I'm working on a project separately. I'm working on a project on the transatlantic slave trade. It's working a lot with Mark Eagle and with Kara Schultz, sort of on broad. Broad overview of the transatlantic slave trade from the beginnings until the mid 1600s, which has been a lot of work too and fun.
I imagine it's been a lot of work, but I also know that when we get the chance to read your next book, we will enjoy it as much as we enjoyed this one. So thank you so much for joining us today, and this was a terrific interview.
Thank you very much again.